Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Lots for us to talk about this week with the Fed 50 basis point rate cut. We did cover a lot on that throughout the tail end of the week and some of the market moves. A lot of different markets moving and continuing to all-time highs. We'll try to filter through what the noise is and what is a sustainable rally for you all, especially in the first couple segments where we chat with Rick Bensignor. And then in the back two segments, we are going to shift our focus over to the energy sector, which in itself is interesting with oil's breakdown to $65 and now very quick rebound back over $70 a barrel. As I mentioned, we are kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies. He writes the institutional newsletter called Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. On the retail and individual side, check out in the No Trader website. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Rick has three products within that. A monthly report called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P. A weekly report called the Tactical Trader Report. And a daily report called the Daily Tip Sheet. Rick, let's start off with the big news from this week that did move markets, kind of expectedly so. That was the Fed rate cut. It seemed like it was a coin flip between 25 basis points and 50 basis points. The Fed went with the bigger rate cut there, 50 basis points, and is now still projecting two more, at least 25 basis point cuts through the rest of this year and even more cuts next year. Rick, what was your takeaway from that Fed statement, the rate cut, and Jerome Powell's press conference this week?
Look, I think Chair Powell finally did what he should have done months ago. But at the same time, I give him credit, which many people don't do. It's a very difficult fine line to walk in order to keep an economy growing, but not have inflation get out of control, which it had. And he's trying to balance these out so not to bring inflation back up, keep the economy growing. And it's not an easy thing. And I think generally he's done a pretty good job. He could have done the cut, I think, back in July. But in general, whether it was 25 or 50 bips, I don't think was the huge thing. He needed to do something, and they finally have. And if you look at, you know, Fed fund futures going out into next year, and even by, let's say, December of next year, you've got the street pretty much looking that the target rate for Fed fund futures, or, well, better said, for Fed funds, is going to be, you know, in the 2.75 to 3% level. So that's well down from where we are now. So the street is looking for cuts to continually happen over time. And the question is, how much of the cuts, at what point does that bring inflation back into the picture? How much, you know, if we get down to 3%, then you've likely increased the odds that inflation returns. And you know, that's not what Chair Powell wants to be seeing with his target rate around 2% or so, and that's their stated mandate. So it's a difficult thing to do. The street generally thinks rates will be coming down over time. The U.S. 10-year probably ultimately gets to 3 to 3.25 or so, but it still has yet to even hit the measured target off of the 5% secular high, which is 3.53. I think the low of the move is 3.60. So, you know, we got, it's only 7 bips. We got close. But in general, you probably want to be looking for rallies in the rate market, or another way of saying that is declines in bond prices, to find places to buy bonds for that move down towards 3.25, 3%. But then I think you probably get into another secular, bigger move higher over time that puts yields back to potentially the 5%, even 6% over time. And if you look historically, you know, that's more of an equilibrium price than where we are now. So we're still in a low interest rate environment. Of course, if you're a 30-year-old kid, you don't think it's low when you try to get a mortgage and recently you had to pay 7%. You know, for me, who's I grew up a kid in the 60s, you get a 7% mortgage. Yeah, that was very normal. That's long-term equilibrium area for mortgage rates. It's just that people are so used to what has been a low interest rate environment for years that, you know, home ownership and the younger generation trying to buy a home and seeing what they have to pay for mortgages, considering 3 years ago, you could have gotten a mortgage for, you know, 2.5-3%. It's shocking to them. But in the world of economics and just cycles, seeing a 7% mortgage is not, you know, it's not out of the norm at all when you look at the long-term picture of where interest rates are. So I think generally, Fed's done a fairly good job. Again, they could have gone a little earlier with the cut, but I'm glad to see Chair Powell has, look, he indicated at Jackson Hole that was likely going, you know, the cut was coming. They did do it. There's more likely coming down the pike, and it's good for the consumer, generally good for stocks. But so much of the post-October 23 rally in the S&P was all based upon the Fed cutting rates. Remember, in January this year, there were 7 cuts priced in by Fed Fund futures traders. Now, you know, we're through the September meeting and they finally cut. So they've been pretty horrific at betting correctly on what the Fed would do. In general, I'd say, you know, that helps keep things positive for the market. But I also think that we're getting closer and closer to major upside targets in the S&P that you could easily see a double-digit fall once we get towards, let's say, 6120, which is a long-term projected target, as well as a medium-term one measured off of a completely different level. They both come into in and around that 610 level for spiders, which is about 6120 or so for the actual cash S&P. So, yes, there's some room with the S&P trading now at about 5,700. Still have 400 points to go. But in the grand scheme of things, I'm not sure we get much above that.
Well, Rick, to that exact point, that's kind of what I wanted to ask you about. If the markets were very excited about this rate cutting cycle a year ago, more than a year ago, really at the end of 2022 coming into 2023, and then all the way through 2023 coming into this year, we've been waiting for these cuts for 2 years. And now that they're here and there's going to be a series of cuts, just a couple points. Usually a rate cutting cycle is not positive for the markets. It may run for a little while, but it tends to show that a market tops. I just saw a chart out this morning that somebody posted, and it was from the Rosenberg Research and Haver Analytics showing that every time there's been a recession, it followed a peak in the Fed's funds rate, which we just saw. And then the third thing would be the yield curve uninverting. The 10 and the 2 have come down a lot, but now the yield curve has steepened. And it's when the yield curve uninverts that you see weakness. With all those things stacking up to the point you just made, could we see the market maybe rally for a little bit, but then could that be the blow off top where we see a double digit correction?
I very much believe so. Yes, I think that's what's likely happening. The cuts will bring some more money into the market. The people who've been on the sidelines will come in, and it would not surprise me whatsoever if the investing public ends up buying the last 5% of the rally before things fall.
Rick, I want to ask you about that whole concept of, yes, rates historically are low, but we can also balance that out with debt levels being much higher and the cost of money or money not being able to get you as much. So I understand back when you were much younger, rates were higher, but house prices were much lower. Now, if you tacked a 10% rate on where the median house price is now, which is multiples higher than when it was 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, it's completely unsustainable. So do we need to adjust what we consider as a historical average for rates because of the fact that money just doesn't get you as much anymore and debt levels are that much higher?
Sure. I mean, you can, instead of looking at rates in a pure vacuum of themselves, you could look at rates, let's say, divided by CPI or some inflation factor that more accurately over time gives you a sense of a proportionality between where they are now and where they had been in the past. So, I mean, it's certainly a fair statement to say that the value now of a dollar is way less than it was 30, 40 years ago. And that's, you know, the inflation factor. It's the same thing. When I think about when I was a kid, what a new car would cost, you know, was, I don't know, $5,000, $6,000. Now you're talking about the average car in America, I think it's about $45,000.
Yeah, we're huge 10X difference on this kind of stuff. Same with home prices.
Yeah. Yeah. Here, I'll give you an example. My parents bought their home. You know, the house I grew up in was a new construction. They bought it in 1958 in a kind of upscale neighborhood on Long Island. And the cost of the house, brand new, from the builder was $18,500. The same thing now, if a builder were to go into that neighborhood and build a brand new home, I don't see how it's less than $1.5 million.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Right? I mean, that's not 10X. That's almost 100X.
Well, Rick, you brought up the dollar. A lot of people have been focused on how this rate cutting cycle could affect the U.S. dollar. So I'd like to get your outlook on it, but also weave in the yen currency has possibly appreciated a little bit over the last, let's say, month or so. But if the dollar starts to weaken, could that exacerbate the yen carry trade again? Because that's where some of that selling pressure came on. So your outlook on the dollar, and could it affect the yen currency as well?
Well, look, there's a few things. Let's address the dollar first. Dollar's been in a trading range for a couple of years now. Roughly, I don't know, let's call it 106. I'm talking the U.S. dollar index. 106 on the upside, about 100-ish, 99, 100-ish on the bottom side. You're just shy of 101 now, so you're on the low end of the range. But you're getting into an easing cycle with rates coming down. And in general, this is not a correlation of 1-to-1, but if rates come down, the U.S. dollar's value will likely come lower too. Now, there are political events and other things. They keep always, you know, a dollar bid to it relative to other currencies. But you could still see general, if the U.S. 10-year gets to 3%, the U.S. dollar is not going to be trading where it is now. It's going to be lower. And the lower dollar is going to make for a higher yen, a higher euro, and, you know, other currencies against the dollar. And the carry trade issue that happened on August 5th that spiked the U.S. markets down and yen up, I've actually been bullish the yen since, because I think it was a change in the market. Now, there's a lot of talk on the street that hedge funds are starting to use the dollar as the source instead of using yen and selling yen in order to then take that money and invest elsewhere. There's a lot of talk that hedge funds are switching to shorting the dollar, that the dollar ends up becoming now the currency that is used versus other ones to raise money to invest in non-dollar denominated assets. And that in and of itself could certainly lead to a whole nother leg down in the dollar. And, you know, if, let's put it this way, if the dollar materially breaks, well, let's just say 99, I got to always give a little leeway from the prior lows. So the lowest low in the U.S. dollar was back in summer of last year, when the U.S. dollar index got to right around 99 and a half. So let's say you break 99 and you stay beneath 99. You're talking about a target at 92 next. That's pretty significant in dollar terms. And if that's the case, that this all kind of works out that way, then yeah, you're going to want to be long the other currencies. And that's, of course, a boost for the metals. Anything that is priced in dollars ends up costing less, which makes crude oil, which is still globally priced in dollars, relatively cheaper. So there's nothing to, I don't think there's anything to do in the dollar right now other than to watch. And you're at the low end of the range. Sure, you could nibble on it and try to play for trading bounces. But if you're looking big time macro, if you break 99 and it's not a, you know, a quick event that comes right back, then you're talking about a substantially weaker dollar coming. And anything that relates to that, you need to be prepared for in your portfolios, because that is a potential significant shift in lots of different ways. It also means that potentially non-US equity markets do better than the U.S. market? I mean, there's a lot of implications if the dollar really breaks beneath the lows of the range. And again, you have to sometimes take your trading hat off and look at the bigger picture. So again, one day, one weekly close underneath the mid, you know, the summer 2023 low doesn't mean, oh, the dollar's gone. But if it breaks again in the neighborhoods of 99 and rallies start failing, then you got a whole nother big move coming down in the dollar, and all the implications for that you need to put into how you think about markets going forward.
Yeah, big change for the markets then with how strong the dollar has been. Let's move to the metals and commodities then. As you said, a weaker dollar can help commodities, but broadly, we've seen a nice bounce in commodities. We still have gold very much leading the way over 2,600. Copper managed to bounce at around that $4 level up to 430 now. Oil did break down, but as I said, is back to $71. Is it commodities in general here, Rick? Could they, if that dollar breaks down, be in for a longer, more sustainable bull market that pushes most commodities to maybe some all-time highs?
Well, look, it certainly can. Let's talk about oil at first, because it's the most globally used commodity and it's the most universally priced in U.S. dollars. That, you know, in gold, but gold is a tiny market compared to what oil is. So you mentioned that oil had gone down to 65 and bounced. It's bounced mostly, in my view, for two reasons. Number one is 2 weeks ago, the Commitment of Traders report showed that hedge funds were more short oil than any time in the history that oil has traded. So any little bit of news that is potentially bullish news can squeeze a lot of people very quickly. So, you know, the Mideast tensions getting higher and this, you know, Hezbollah sending endless rockets into Israel, and then Israel this week pulling off, I don't know, I'll call it beeper gate, or I don't know what you want to call it. What's going on is just heightening tensions, Iran threatening more and more, saying we're getting, you know, can get involved and are planning to get involved. That's where the bid comes from oil. There seemingly is, you know, from the fundamental point of view, there's lots of oil out there. The U.S. output of oil is immense. We can, you know, provide oil for not only America, but for lots of the world. That's how much supply is being generated by the U.S. And we're no longer OPEC dependent the same way. And, you know, oil could very well be capped in the, you know, mid-80s or something like that, just on any type skirmish type rally because of supply issues. So if you see something happen that spikes oil up and open interest unwind such that shorts end up getting squeezed out and they're paying for lower price shorts to people who are long and getting out. So if open interest falls on a spike up in oil, you know that those who are long are selling out to those who are being forced to pay up because they're trying to avoid larger losses. That's a clue that you really don't have enough demand for oil to keep prices up. It's a trading type of move. It's not a whole change in fundamentals. If the dollar goes down, it universally helps the price of oil. That's a good thing. But whether or not this translates into a whole run-up in commodities is a different story. Gold is getting close to, we've talked about this a month ago. I mean, I've got targets within where gold is now. You're less than $100 from major targets. I think gold is close to getting a peak. And others will argue gold's going to $3,000. I personally don't think it is, not in this piece of the cycle, not without seeing a few $100 pullback. Gold could easily get down towards $2,400 again, $2,450, where it broke out from several months ago. So you could easily, you know, you could get a 10% pullback in gold. And I'm not sure you really have much more than a 10% upside from here. So I would not be buying personally, you know, even on a day like now where gold's up big today and is making, again, new all-time highs. Would I be buying gold up here? I'm not. I think people who are buying gold here are most likely forced to buy gold because they're short from lower levels. And then you have the gold bugs who they're bullish anytime. And if you're a member of the public who does not follow the price of gold and you see some TV ad that says, you know, buy gold, it's up such and such percent in the last 10 years or last 20 years. Yeah, gold has been actually a phenomenal investment. And I've been long gold for, I don't know, 10 or 15 years in my own accounts. And I was, remember, I was a commodities trader. I was a pit trader. I traded COMEX gold of one of the many things that I traded on the floor of the exchange. So I've been intimately involved in that market for years and years. From an investment point of view, I've been long 10, 15 years worth in gold, and it's paid off really well. It's done probably in the last 20 years, give or take, you're probably close to what the S&P has returned. I mean, it's been a heck of a good longer term investment. But I do think we're getting closer to a place that you really have to question how much more gold has to the upside. And if the dollar falls, it'll certainly help. And then if I sell out of some up, you know, somewhere around here, I'll probably end up being wrong. But if the dollar doesn't materially break, then, you know, gold is due for a few $100 pullback and something to consider reducing rather than just, you have to think about too, when you're an investor or a trader, who's telling you to do what and when they tell you to do it is always important. And most people don't think in those terms. But when you start hearing people hawking gold, you know, it's funny. They don't hawk it when it's $1,000 an ounce. They hawk it when it's $2,000 an ounce and $2,500 an ounce. Always easy to hawk something when it's in a trend and seems like the right thing. But just like perma bulls, you know, there are people on TV all the time who, no matter what happens in the market, are going to tell you to be a buyer. And, you know, in this day and age, we kind of know who that one person is who is forever on TV and only talks about the stock market in one way. And yes, this person's been right to be bullish. But if you're a strategist and you're not mostly bullish the stock market over time, you're a fool. Look at a 100-year chart of the Dow or the S&P and tell me which way should you be, bullish or bearish. You know, if you're a public-facing strategist, you should be bullish most of the time. So that to me is useless information to be bullish the stock market. Everybody knows to be bullish the stock market. The value of a good strategist is to tell you when to be bearish and to be right about that. And the perma bulls don't, to me, provide any value because they're telling you what everybody in the public already knows, which is over time you want to be long equities.
Well, Rick, just following up on kind of weaving a couple of these ideas together with the dollar, with gold, with inflation, what does it say? Because so many people look at the dollar index, but that's really weighted against maybe six other global currencies. And you're looking at the dollar
mostly
rising.
The euro.
Mostly the euro. Yeah, yeah, a little bit of yen, a little bit of the pound. But when you look at gold, when it was unpegged in 1971, it was $35 greenbacks. You know,
1974.
Yeah. Yeah. And so 35 greenbacks to get 1 ounce of gold. Gold hasn't changed. It's on the elemental table. It's just a rock. But now it takes 2,648 greenbacks to buy one. So when people look at that, what does that say about the loss of purchasing power in the dollar and the effects of inflation on, you know, even the house example you mentioned? You know, how does inflation tie into your investing thesis when, you know, some of these things are assets that can levitate you out of the dangers of inflation?
Yeah, that's why everybody should own some gold in their portfolio. And generally, I have said traditionally, 3%, maybe 5%, but not more than 5%. Because traditionally, anything more than that was you were truly betting on the price of gold to do better than the stock market did. And honestly, in the last 20 years, I'm pretty sure it's been pretty equal to the S&P. So it's been an extraordinary period of time to be long gold. But if you look at the 20 years before that, you did not do well being long gold versus the market. And so, yeah, you should have some gold as a hedge against inflation, and it has acted nicely as one. So it has served its role. But if you look at the S&P, they're fairly comparable. If you look at any Mag 7 name versus gold, I'd say you did better in Mag 7, and remarkably so. So, you know, it belongs in your portfolio. It's a matter of how much and at what price you get in relative to where it is in its trend. You know, as you say, you're paying the most now than, you know, you buy gold today. It's the most expensive it has ever been in the history of purchasing gold. So
even when you compare it to inflation adjusted, too.
Correct. Correct.
So, Rick, what does this mean for the gold equities? Do you see opportunity because the gold equities have lagged this move in gold so much? Just look at a chart of GDX, a longer-term chart of GDX compared to gold. It's vastly different, not even close to its all-time highs. Gold keeps hitting all-time highs. Do you see the opportunity of investors to leverage this move in gold for a catch-up trade within the gold stocks?
In theory, it should. And if you had asked me any time prior to where we are now, I would say, yes, you, as much as you want to own GLD, you want to own GDX also because it is so miserably underperformed gold. So if you think about a rubber band that's been stretched, the disparity between the price of gold and GDX is so large, you would think gold miners should catch up to some degree. But if we look at GDX, which is trading at $40 and change, the all-time high in GDX was back in 2011. And there it got to, $67, right? It's trading $40 now. So you got this thing needs to increase 50% to get to all-time highs at the same time that gold is on all-time highs. So it's either telling you that gold miners are a horrific investment over time, and that you're much better off in gold, or you're finally going to correct and GDX, you know, ends up making a substantial up move. Now, since this thing peaked in 2011, when it went from, what did I say, $67, it got down to 12 and a half, right? So it lost, what is that, 80%, something like that? I'm not sure. My math in my head quickly, but something in that neighborhood. I mean, it lost something like 80%. If you look at the charts, it's been trying to make a bottom now for years. And if it breaks out above the 2020 high, which was about $46, it could then run to 51-ish, 52 or so, the 2012 high. But then it has plenty of room to go, technically, up to anything remotely close to what the all-time highs are. So I've got about a 50-50, personally, I have about a 50-50 split between gold and GDX. And clearly the gold was the much better investment over time. I'm willing to hold GDX for the hope that, you know, 5 years from now, I'm right for having held it and that it plays some significant catch up. The one thing that I worry about a bit is that because I only think the S&P has a few percent more to go before topping and then selling off double digits percentage-wise, GDX is gold stocks. So they're stocks first and gold stocks second. If the market comes off, GDX may very well come off too. So if you can't get the breakout above 2020's high at, 46-ish in GDX, and the S&P peaks and starts falling, then I think this GDX breakout to the upside just gets delayed, and it's more kind of pain. You've got a fairly flat 200-week moving average at a little beneath 32 now. So if we're at 40, that's one that's 20% down to get to kind of, you know, the average price over the last several years. It's a tough thing. Gold miners, you know, just haven't performed. And the juniors have been a disaster. So I think you hold on to GDX and then you hope that the situation, something comes about that ultimately changes what's happened for the last 10 years and finally gives, you know, gold miners some type of boost to the upside. So I'm going to probably hold on to my GDX, but I'll probably reduce some of the outright gold ownership.
Rick, I'd also like to get your thoughts on copper. We get a lot of thoughts on the good doctor, and I wonder if the dollar falling could be more of a driver for it, or if the potential recession and contraction that so many are still looking for, not just in the U.S., but in China and Europe, how does that weigh on copper?
So look, copper's bounced the last couple of weeks, but it's nothing special. 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, it was on its slightly upward slope, 200-week moving average. A bottom between $3.90 and $4. We're talking U.S. COMEX copper. And now it's trading at, $4.35-ish, something in that neighborhood. Without China, I don't see copper getting a major move higher. So it's, right now it's bottom where it needed to, which is in the last 2 months, multiple weekly lows traded down to even sometimes through the 200-week moving average, but it basically bounced from there, as well as a major uptrend line also going back much farther in time. So if you go back to the July, 2022 low, the lowest low in copper, in the whole cycle, the recent low about 6 weeks ago was somewhat near there. And let me see. And also near the trend line from last October's low. So technically, it's bouncing on some support. China is kind of a dead issue right now. Second largest economy in the world, but a crappy, phase it's in now. Their stock market's horrific. It's not investable. And China's not, materially buying copper right now. So I've got no particular opinion on copper. Where we're trading now is also where the January 2023 high was. So this is kind of an inflection point also. There's other markets to trade. Unless you're in the copper industry, whether as a buyer or a seller, there's no reason for the average investor to be looking at copper.
All right, Rick, we'll wrap it up here. Thank you so much for your time and breaking down a bit more of a focus on your trading strategies around commodities. Again, Rick Bensinger, president of Bensinger Investment Strategies. Click that link in the show notes to visit the In the Know Trader website. Read over the different products that Rick has for all of you individual traders managing your own portfolios. It's always insightful hearing how you're viewing these markets, Rick, and I look forward to following up with you later next month. Everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.